Hello, I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. These lectures are part of the Superstar Teachers series, produced by the Teaching Company. The lectures on these tapes are titled Economics, Part 2, Macroeconomics. The lecturer is Professor Timothy Taylor. Professor Taylor graduated from Haverford College in 1982 and received his master's degree in economics from Stanford University in 1984. Currently, he is the managing editor of the Journal of Economic Perspectives. Professor Taylor has taught introductory economics at Stanford University and at the University of Minnesota. His students and colleagues at both schools have acknowledged his outstanding teaching ability. In 1992, the Associated Students of Stanford University recognized him with an award for excellent teaching in a large class. And in 1994, he was named Distinguished Lecturer by the Department of Economics at the University of Minnesota. Professor Taylor has been a guest speaker for visiting diplomats from Eastern Europe, community organizations, and a variety of radio programs. Lecture 11, The Macroeconomic Perspective on Long-Term Growth.
This lecture marks a shift from microeconomics to macroeconomics. As we discussed back in Lecture 1, microeconomics is the bottom-up view of the economy, where we look at individually rational actions, households and firms, in product, labor, and credit markets. Macroeconomics is the top-down vision of the economy. We're looking at the overall economy and reaching conclusions about its structure. An obvious question comes up when you think about it in this way. Why isn't macroeconomics just sort of microeconomics blown up like a big balloon? Why isn't it just all the microeconomics markets taken together? Why do we need a different sort of logic if we're thinking about macroeconomics? The answer to that question is that when you take microeconomically rational behavior and put it together, you can get a situation which doesn't seem rational or logical. Let me give you an example of that. Imagine that you're at a big stadium and you're watching some sort of an event, a sporting event, a concert, something like that. And a few people stand up in order to get a better view. From a microeconomic point of view, rational people trying to get a better view, those folks looking, standing up to get the better view are doing something that makes perfectly good sense. However, from a macroeconomic point of view, those few people stand up, a few more people stand up. A few more people stand up, a few more people stand up, and eventually everyone is standing up. You have a situation where instead of being comfortably seated, everyone is now uncomfortably standing, and no one has a better view than they did before. The macroeconomically rational thing of trying to get a better view led to a situation where no one had a better view. That kind of problem can come up in several different contexts in macroeconomics, that kind of problem where microeconomically rational thinking leads to odd situations. Microeconomic thinking also has no way of explaining the basic macroeconomic issues that we wanted to talk about. For example, our microeconomic thinking gave us a lot of tools for thinking about price and quantity, but it gave us no way at all of thinking about a question like, why does the entire economy as a whole grow? It gave us a lot of reasons for thinking about, say, the price of wheat or the price of cars or the price of labor or the interest rate, but why is it that all prices simultaneously might go up, as in the case of inflation, rather than just one price in one market or another? How does trade and the effect of national borders affect markets and change our thinking? What about issues like the budget deficit? What about issues like the Federal Reserve? All of those are issues that microeconomics really doesn't have a heck of a lot to say about. So what we need to do in thinking about macroeconomics is build upon our structure of microeconomics, and then as we build on it, work toward ways of thinking about these broader overall economic issues. Let me start off by giving you all a basic structure to think about. The basic structure is that we can think of macroeconomics as a matter of four goals and two tools. The four goals are more rapid economic growth, or just sustainable, good, positive economic growth, a low rate of inflation, a low rate of unemployment, and what I'll just call a sustainable trade deficit. And by sustainable, I mean a trade deficit which, over time, is neither too big nor too small. Let me leave that ambiguous now. I'll explain more what I mean by that in Lecture 14. There are two tools, broadly speaking, that government folks have to manipulate the macroeconomy. One set of tools, which are called fiscal policy, refer to the budget of the federal government and its spending and taxing power. So when you hear someone refer to fiscal policy, they're just referring to spending and taxing power. That's all it means. There's nothing more complicated than that. The other big tool the federal government has, or set of tools, is referred to as monetary power. And monetary power is the authority that the government has over interest rates and the money supply. That's exercised through the Federal Reserve. Those terms, money supply, Federal Reserve, may be things that don't make a lot of sense to you just now. We'll spend a whole lecture on them in Lecture 15 and then come back and talk after that for a while. What we want to think about, though, is how the government can manipulate these two tools. These tools are fiscal policy and monetary policy in order to try and achieve these goals of more rapid growth, lower unemployment, lower inflation, and the balance of trade. And take all of that into account with an overall global view of the economy. It's a fairly high order of business. What we want to try and start doing in this lecture is to look in particular at the problem of economic growth. And the next four lectures will look at the four goals of macroeconomic policy. Let's think about the goal of economic growth. Let me start off on this note. Let me offer you a choice, and you're going to have to vote here, so hold your thoughts for a moment. Here's first choice. The choice is, let's say that we're going to ask which decade you want to live in terms of standard of living. One choice is to live in the present, with more or less an average late 1990s kind of standard of living. The other choice is to live in 1925, but in 1925, you get to have 10 times as much income as the average family would have now. So if the average family in the U.S. in the late 1990s gets about $40,000 in income, you'd be living in 1925, but you would have $400,000 in income. Now, of course, back in 1925, when wages were much, much lower than they are today, people like my grandmother, who was a nurse at the time, might have earned $900 a year back then. So if you had $400,000, you had an extraordinary sum of money. I mean, servants, big house, the whole thing. So the question is, would you like to live in the present, average American standard of living, or would you like to live in 1925, very, very rich person? The difficult part of this is that if you choose the 1925 standard of living, you have to live only with technologies that were available in 1925. You have to really live in 1925. So only things which were available in 1925 can comprise your standard of living. So, here we vote. On one hand, how many people would like to choose the present standard of living? And on the other hand, how many people would like to choose the 1925 standard of living? The way this usually works out in class when I ask large groups of people is it's roughly a 2-to-1 vote for the present. I found that when I ask older groups, when I speak to community groups or different things like that, the vote is usually a little more evenly divided, but we still have a majority vote for the present. And if you think about that for a moment, it makes some sense. I mean, after all, if you were to live in 1925, you have, for one thing, no antibiotics, a fairly big thing in most people's life. If you think about traveling, you're really talking about rattle-trap old cars. You're not talking about flying in cruise ships around the world. Many people might like the idea of having a lot of servants, but personally, I would take a dishwasher and clothes dryer and all those kinds of modern conveniences, the microwave, over trying to manage a household of servants any day. There's, of course, no right answer to this question. You might think that you really would prefer to live in 1925, and that's a perfectly legitimate choice here. The point I'm trying to make is that the advantages of modern technology, of movies, of CDs, of culture, of travel, of education, of health, are such large advantages that for many, many people, if you could live with them, you'd be willing to give up extraordinary wealth at another time and place. I think that's kind of a remarkable thought, and a thought which tells us something. It tells us that economic growth matters. It tells us that new technology matters. And if I would offer you all the choice of an average standard of living in the present versus an average standard of living 3/4 of a century ago, my guess is that almost everyone would choose the present. Because after all, the present has so much great stuff that just wasn't available to people back in 1925. When we think about growth, when we think about the economy changing over time, what do we actually mean by growth? What are the terms we're using there? Well, the measure of the economy that's typically used by economists is GDP, which stands for gross domestic product. Now, you may have heard from time to time abbreviations like GNP for gross national product, NNP for net national product. These are all closely related concepts. It's not worth spending time here going into the differences between them. Let's just say that we're going to use gross domestic product, GDP, which is the single most commonly used measure of what an economy really is. I'm going to give some examples that are taken from 1997, a recent year. The point, of course, is not the specific numbers in these examples, but it's thinking about the overall structure of the macroeconomy and how it fits together. In 1997, the gross domestic product was about $8 trillion. That's trillion with a T, or $8,000 billion. That number, of course, will change over time. If you want to look up a recent number, you can look it up on a variety of government websites or in books like the Economic Report of the President or the Statistical Abstract of the United States. You can measure gross domestic product in a variety of different ways. In fact, going back to our earlier thinking, you can measure gross domestic product as a matter of demand or as a matter of supply in the overall economy. Let's first of all think about what's supplied in the overall economy. One way of breaking up gross domestic product into supply categories is to break it up into major categories of what the economy actually produces. And for example, in 1997, you can break it up into various kinds of goods, various kinds of services, and various kinds of structures. In particular, if you do this kind of a division, you find that durable goods being things like refrigerators, cars, solid things that last for a period of time, are about 16% of the overall economy. Non-durable goods, things like food, that household products that get used up over time, are 22% of the overall GDP. Services, that is, haircuts, real estate, finance, law, all those kinds of things that you buy, are actually 55% of the gross domestic product. And structures, homes, new office buildings, things like that, come out to 9% of gross domestic product. That structure is odd to a lot of people. A lot of people, when you think about the economy, almost the first things that come to mind are things like cars and computers, all in that category of durable goods, things that last a long period of time. But remember, those things are only 16% of the overall economy. A lot of people are kind of shocked that services, for example, are 55% of the overall economy. But that structure, where services are the overwhelming share of the U.S. economy, has actually been true for some decades now. And it shouldn't really come as a huge surprise if you go back and look up the numbers. Let's look at the demand side of the economy. On the demand side, if we think about buying and what's purchased in the U.S. economy, we can divide that up into five big categories according to who does the buying. And those five categories, as you'll see in any economics course, are sometimes referred to as C plus I plus G plus X minus M. Let me tell you what each of those means. C stands for consumption. Consumption is the single biggest part of the economy in terms of demand. That's the demand coming from households. And now that's about 68% of the U.S. economy. Investment is the demand by businesses for purchasing plant and equipment. That demand is 15% of the overall economy. Demand by government for goods and services is 18% of the overall economy. And I should say there that in this particular categorization, when the government does something like Social Security, where it takes money and hands it out to people, that's not counted as government spending, because the consumption there is not actually done by the government. That's counted as consumption by the consumers who actually get those Social Security payments. So when we talk about the government consuming, we're talking about the government hiring military people, building roads, actually buying things for its own use or for its own public purposes. So government is 18% of the economy. Then we need to take in the foreign sector, exports and imports. Exports to other countries are about 12% of the overall economy, about 1/8. And then imports from other countries are about 13% of the overall economy in 1997. And You have to add exports to the overall economy. That's demand for U.S. goods and services, so you add that in. On the other side of the equation, though, you have to subtract out the imports. You have to subtract them out because that's not demand for U.S. products. That's demand from the U.S. for products that were produced other places. So you take consumption, add investment, add government spending, add the demand for U.S. exports, subtract out imports, and that gives you overall what the demand, the aggregate overall demand is for goods in the macroeconomic sense. Of those different categories, the one that jumps up and down the most year to year is investment. And the reason for that is simply that business investment is something where businesses wait until they think it's really a good time to invest. Think about it for a moment. If you were running a business, there's going to be some years when the economy is really not doing very well at all, when the economy is kind of staggering, actually. And in those years when the economy is staggering, no business or very few businesses are going to think like it's a good idea to invest. Other years, the economy may be doing quite a bit better. And in those years, practically all businesses are going to want to invest. So what you see when you look at investment is big falls and big rises as the economy goes up and down. Whereas consumption spending, people buying things, government buying things, even foreigners buying things, tends by comparison not to leap up and down nearly as much. When you add up the overall demand side of the economy, C plus I plus G plus X minus M, and you add up the supply side of the economy, durable goods, non-durable goods, services, structures, those two have to add up to the same thing. They have to add up to the same thing because they're measuring the same thing. You can't have supply for something on the one side unless there's also demand for it on the other side. So when you add up all the supply in the economy and all the demand in the economy, either way, you're going to get gross domestic product at the end of the day, about $8 trillion. There are two more useful adjustments which are typically made to gross domestic product. One is to make an adjustment for inflation. And this adjustment is sometimes referred to as figuring out real gross domestic product. Think about this for a moment, just on a one-year-to-one-year kind of basis. Let's say that the overall gross domestic product, when we look at the number, goes up 5%. But in that same year, we know that inflation is 3%. Well, if you think about that for a moment, you'd say to yourself, overall, 3% of the rise in gross domestic product was just due to inflation. It was just due to prices being higher. It wasn't actually that more goods and services got produced. The other 2% was the addition in real GDP, in real goods and services. So just in the same way we did with interest rates, where we divided up into nominal interest rates and real interest rates, what we want to do here is think about nominal GDP and real GDP. That is, real changes represent actual changes in the goods and services produced, whereas nominal GDP includes the changes that happen because of changes in inflation and the price level. Obviously, if you're looking at growth in the economy, what you care about is real gross domestic product. You care about the goods and services being produced. You don't care about whether or not it happened because of inflation and that artificially made the economy look larger. The other adjustment which it's useful to make is per capita gross domestic product. And all that means is to take the overall size of the economy and divide it by the number of people. If you take real gross domestic product and you divide by the number of people, then you've got something which adjusts for the fact that some economies, like the U.S., just have very large countries with a lot of population, and other economies have a smaller number of people. But if we're trying to compare across countries, we would like to adjust for the number of people. Right now, if you look at the world economy is about $28 trillion, and the world population is about 5.8 billion people. If you divide those two, you get a world per capita gross domestic product of about $4,800 per person. If you look just at the United States, we have a gross domestic product of $8 trillion. We have 270 million people. Divide those two, you get $29,600 per person. Those sorts of comparisons, U.S. per capita GDP of almost $30,000 a person, global GDP of perhaps $5,000 a person, begin to tell you something about imbalances and things in the global economy which lead a lot of people to worry about being overtaken by trade. Those are issues we'll be taking up in the final few lectures of this series, lectures 19 and 20. So what we really want to look at here is real per capita gross domestic product. That's the important number to be looking at. And we want to think about growth in terms of growth in real per capita gross domestic product. But before going further in thinking about growth in those terms, I should say that there are some real problems and legitimate problems with how we think about gross domestic product and how we think about it in particular as a measure of our own well-being. There's a real tendency sometimes to say more gross domestic product is always good. It just means that you're better off. And we don't want to say that. We want to back away from that conclusion and explicitly not draw that conclusion. Some of the problems with gross domestic product look like this. Remember, gross domestic product measures what's bought and sold in an economy. That's all it measures. Just measures what's bought and sold. It doesn't measure, for example, time off. Imagine that everyone in the economy could work, 5 hours less per week, but we all produced the same amount. It's a hypothetical example, but imagine it were true. Gross domestic product would look exactly the same. But clearly, if people had more time off, then they would be better off in some meaningful sense. Leisure is not counted as part of the gross domestic product. The environment is not counted. If the economy went up and up and the environment went down and down, it might be right to say that, boy, these two are not balancing out properly. Maybe this increase in our standard of living is not really happening. We need to take the decline in the environment into account. We need to take that into account, but as mentioned back in Lecture 8, in the United States at least, both the environment and the economy have been going up for the last several decades. So while you would want to adjust for the environment, the adjustment is a little bit different than one might at first think. There are also a lot of things in the GDP, in what's bought and sold, which it's hard to think of as being good things. For example, imagine there's a disaster, a terrible storm, an earthquake, a hurricane, something like that, and as a result, people end up rebuilding large parts of some town. Well, that counts as material which is bought and sold, but it would be hard to say that, well, we rebuilt this town, there's more gross domestic product. That's a good thing that we had that earthquake. It's a good thing that we had that hurricane. Sometimes it seems like what we're producing in the economy are bads or reactions to bad things rather than things that we would really like to have. You can think of a lot of spending on crime prevention and police as falling into that category of, it's hard to say that it makes us a lot happier to have that. It's not exactly like a trip to the beach. Gross domestic product measures only what's marketed. Think about this example for a moment. Imagine that my neighbor and I decide to swap jobs, to swap household jobs. The neighbor comes over to our house and cleans and cooks and does all those kinds of things. And I go over to the neighbor's house and I cook and clean and do all those kinds of things. And we pay each other back and forth. Well, if we do those things in our own houses, nothing is being bought and sold. And if nothing's being bought and sold, it doesn't count in gross domestic product. If we swap houses and pay each other, now things are being bought and sold, and it would count in gross domestic product, even though exactly the same amount of work is being done either way. This factor is particularly important in the U.S. economy during the 1970s and into the 1980s, as more and more women left household work for paid work. And more people began to pay for services like food preparation, cleaning your house, and different things like that. Those added to gross domestic product, but it's not clear that they really added to our well-being in a meaningful sense. And finally, gross domestic product doesn't take health directly into account. It doesn't take into account longer life expectancies, or less infant mortality, or fewer diseases, or anything like that. So, I don't want to minimize these issues. These issues matter. And in some cases, they may well mean that when you look at gross domestic product going up, you might want to say to yourself, boy, I'm not quite sure what that's telling me. I need to look over at these other sorts of figures and see whether there's some counterbalancing sort of factor which might be offsetting any rise in gross domestic product. I certainly would not say we should sacrifice health or sacrifice the environment for gross domestic product. No economist would make a claim like that. Every now and then you hear someone say, well, all economists care about is GDP. That's just silliness. Economists care about making people happy in the broadest sense, and all these things are clearly part of making people happy. But at the same time, I don't want to overreact here. I don't want to lose what's important in gross domestic product. I don't want to lose what's measurable in gross domestic product. A famous economist named Robert Solow, a Nobel laureate in his own right, once wrote that if you have to be obsessed by one number, real gross domestic product is a good number to choose. Now, of course, it's best not to be obsessed with one number. It's best just not to choose one number and worry about it all the time. But real gross domestic product, per capita real gross domestic product, really does tell you something. Over and over, you find that societies which have a higher real per capita GDP really do seem to have a higher standard of living in many, many dimensions, including health and the environment and many other things. So if you sort of think of it as a marker for a higher standard of living, not a perfect measure, but a marker, I think it does tell you something which is worth knowing and worth learning about. So imagine that we're looking at growth. Imagine that we're looking at real per capita GDP over time. And that's really where we're focused. What is the power of that growth over time? Why do we care about economic growth? Well, the important reason for thinking about growth is that, like interest rates, growth compounds over time. That is to say, just as in interest rates, you get interest on the past interest if you let the money sit in the account. With economic growth, your growth grows based on the growth you've already had in the past. The formula for thinking about economic growth is actually mathematically exactly the same formula as thinking about growth for interest rates. It's just compounding. And so we can think about that formula in this way. You take the present value of the economy, which we could call P. You multiply it times 1 plus the growth rate, which might be, say, 2% a year, 5% a year, 8% a year, some number like that. We take 1 plus the growth rate, raise it to the power of T for how many years that happens, and that will equal whatever the future value of the economy is. Now, to try and illustrate the power of growth, let me give you a few different examples. Where we start off with an economy which, just for the sake of simplicity, we'll say that gross domestic product is equal to 100, exactly 100. And let's start off by saying that that economy grows at 1% a year. 1% a year I choose not just hypothetically, but because for the last, 25 years or so, that's not been a bad approximation for the real per capita growth in the U.S. economy. It's been a little faster than that, but not necessarily a whole lot faster. Well, if we apply our formula for growth, and we say, all right, we start off at 100, we grow at 1% a year. After 10 years, then where do we stand? After 10 years, the economy would be up to 110. After 20 years, the GDP would be up to 128. And after 40 years, after we'd taken compounding into account, the economy would be 149. So after 40 years, the economy would be about 50% bigger than it was before, growing at a 1% rate. Now let's think about growth as a 3% rate. And a 3% rate is somewhat similar to the growth rate of the U.S. economy in several decades after World War II, say through the 50s and 60s and up to the early 1970s when growth slowed down. Again, we start off with a GDP of 100. After 10 years, that would be up to 134. After 25 years, it would be up to 209. And after 40 years, it would be 326. Now, that movement from 1% to 3% growth clearly has a really large impact over 40 years. Remember that over 40 years at a 1% growth rate, the economy only grew 50%. But at a 3% growth rate, the economy literally more than triples in 40 years. And 40 years is clearly within the lifetime of individuals. That's, say, from when you're a baby up until middle age, or from when you're a young adult up until your 60s. Now let's think about growth in terms of a 5% growth rate. 5% would be a really good year for the United States, and a year when the U.S. economy really boomed. It's the sort of rate that countries like Brazil and Mexico had year in, year out in the 1960s, before things really went bad for them in the 1970s and 1980s. At a 5% rate of growth, we start off with a GDP of 100. Then, after 10 years, the economy would be 163. After 25 years, it would be 339, almost tripling. And after 40 years, it would be 704. So that 5% rate of growth means that after 40 years, the economy would have gone up by a factor of 7, a multiple of 7. That's just an astonishing thing to think about, moving by a multiple of 7 over the course of less than one person's lifetime. But let's take it one step further. Let's talk about a growth rate of 8%. And 8% would be extremely fast growth. Now we're talking about a growth rate similar to, say, Japan in the 1960s and 70s, China from the 1970s to the 1980s and into the 1990s, South Korea in the 1970s, some of the really exceptional cases of growth that have occurred around the world. So 8% growth, start out with a GDP of 100. After 10 years, just 10 years, the economy would already have doubled up to 216. After 25 years, the economy would have multiplied by a factor of almost 7, up to 685. And after 40 years, if you could sustain that growth rate for 40 years, and there's no economy which has shown an ability to keep 8% growth going for 40 years, but if you could, the economy would go from 100 up to almost 2,200. In those 40 years, within the lifetime of one person, within half their lifetime, the economy overall would have multiplied by a factor of 22. Lesson from all this. Lesson. Small differences in growth make huge differences over time. Huge differences. When you think about countries in this world like Britain and Argentina, Britain and Argentina, if you go back to the beginning of the 20th century, were probably two of the wealthiest five countries in the world. By the end of the 20th century, Britain is below the average for Europe. And Argentina, heck, Argentina, out of all the countries in the world, probably ranks 75th or 80th or something like that in per capita GDP. What happened to Britain and Argentina? It wasn't a one-time thing where one year things went wrong. It was year in, year out, year in, year out. They were always 1 or 2% behind. And 1 or 2% behind just eats you up over time. Conversely, if you think about countries like Japan and South Korea, sure they had some good rapid growth rates, but the important thing was they were able to sustain those growth rates for a couple of decades. And that moved them from relatively poor countries in the world to relatively wealthy countries within a generation. A really remarkable achievement, the more you think about it. It takes a long, long time for an economy that's behind to catch up. A rapid rate of growth might be 5, 6, 7%. If you start off of being a poor country, being perhaps 20% of the U.S. level of income, 30% of the U.S. level of income, to close that gap of 60 or 70% is going to take a couple of generations. You're only going to close it maybe 1 or 2% a year. So growth worries, when you think about them, need to be long-term worries. They're not worries about what happens next year. They're not worries about what happens in the next 3 months. Do interest rates go up or down? They're worries about what kind of a foundation are we setting that will go on as we look off into the future 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. And over that time period, there's nothing else that matters nearly so much. What is it that causes growth? Well, gross domestic product can grow for a lot of reasons, and we've talked about some of those reasons before. One reason would be, for example, just because prices went up, inflation in other words. But we're going to take that out. We're just going to look at growth in real domestic product. We could also imagine the economy getting bigger and bigger. And if the economy was getting bigger and bigger, then the gross domestic product would be growing. But we're going to look at per capita gross domestic product, and so we're going to take out population. We could also imagine that although population wasn't going up, people were working more and more and more hours. And so the economy was growing because people were working longer hours. This clearly would be a sort of mixed message for whether people were really better off. I mean, if everyone had to work a 60-hour week, I have no doubt that we could produce more gross domestic product. I'm not sure we'd be healthier or happier as a society as a result of doing that. But fortunately, in the U.S. economy, the average hours worked by an average worker have been coming down a lot, but a little bit, over the last few decades. So it's just not true that there are enormous increases in the number of hours being worked. So we're trying to focus in here on one particular reason for why the economy would grow. And that reason is productivity growth. The way to think about productivity growth would be if you have the same number of people working the same number of hours, but they produce more. So it's the same number of people, same number of hours, and output overall has gone up. What are the causes of productivity growth? What makes productivity growth go up? Well, let me give you three broad categories for thinking about why productivity growth might go up. One would be investment in physical capital, new machinery, stuff like that. If you have investment in physical capital, presumably what that means is that people who are working out there, working that same number of hours, have better equipment to work with. And if they have better equipment to work with, then they'll be able to produce more over time. A second possibility would be investment in human capital. And human capital is that nice economist's way, that nice humane economist's way. To a lot of people, it sort of seems to compare people to equipment. But economists pointed out several decades ago that when you invest in education, really that's an investment just like an investment in machinery. It's an investment where you put money in now, and then you expect to be getting a return over time on that investment. And that return over time can be thought of as an investment in human capital, just like one would think about an investment in physical capital. If we raise education levels, we have more skilled and smarter workers, people who've worked more years, then that change in human capital investment over time, which, say, can be both education and skill, would also mean that workers would be able to produce more in the same amount of time. Their productivity would be up. And a final broad category would be technology. We could imagine people having more or less the same capital in terms of dollar value, or more or less the same education in terms of how many years of school. But if they have access to better technology, better ways of doing things, then they're going to be in a much better position to think about pushing long-term growth. And technology here, I don't just mean big inventions like the laser or something like that. When I think about technology, I sometimes think about smaller inventions, things like laser printers getting better and better and cheaper and more efficient over time, and also things that don't necessarily have to do with the physical technology, but might have to do with the way you organize your production process. For example, the invention of the assembly line was clearly a new technology, a new way of producing. It just wasn't a new piece of machinery or something like the laser or the telephone that you could put your finger on. There are all kinds of examples out there of better human resource practices which encourage the same people to work harder than they were working before or work smarter. And those kinds of things are all thought of as new technology in this framework. So, if we were to divide up the world, physical investment, human capital investment, technology, as three different reasons for why the economy might grow, here you get to vote again, which categories do you think would be biggest and which do you think would be smallest? Well, there have been a variety of studies done on this over time, an awful lot of them, going back to the 1950s. And depending on how they conceptualize the issue, they come up with somewhat different answers, of course. But it's a fair statement to say that a mainstream kind of result would be that physical capital investment, that is new machinery, is about one quarter, one fourth of the growth in productivity. Investment in human capital would be another one fourth or so of new productivity. And technology would be half, or in some studies up to perhaps 80% of the growth in productivity. Now, this result requires a little bit of thought. It's worth saying, first of all, that physical capital, human capital, and technology are all to some extent interdependent. If you've got smarter workers, after all, they tend to invent more new things. If they're inventing more new things, then you've got a situation where they're going to invent more things, it'll make more sense for the company to invest in other kinds of physical equipment. New physical equipment means you have to have more skilled workers to run that equipment a lot of time. And perhaps because you have new equipment, then new ideas occur to people about how to rearrange the factory and perhaps other equipment. So there are many virtuous circles here going on, and all these things are somewhat interdependent. I wouldn't say that you can just work on one area and not work on other areas, but that said, that there is some interdependence between them, it's still, I think, fascinating that most people, if you ask them where productivity comes from, they have a tendency to say machinery comes from investment. It comes from more people having more investment. And physical investment, which uses resources, is really about a quarter, and in some studies less, of the source of productivity growth. What really matters are these intangible things, these ideas, more skilled workers coming up with new ways of doing things and new ways of investing. New technologies. And those are just, in every study, overwhelmingly important to thinking about what's important for the long-term health of the economy. Now, I should say that these sorts of conclusions are actually particularly relevant for the United States, countries in Europe, and developed economies of the world. If you look at some of the really poor countries of the world, what you tend to see, and in fact this is true for the United States as well if you go back into the 19th century, that for a period of time there, their gains, their economy, their productivity growth really does come out of new machinery and new physical capital investment. And when an economy is first getting started, first growing, that machinery really makes a big difference. But after you've got a lot of the machinery in place and you're quite a developed economy, it seems that what happens is the physical equipment, the machinery, becomes somewhat less important. And what becomes more and more important is the skill of the workers using it and the technology that's available to them. One of the most vivid examples of this is post-World War II Europe, post-World War II Germany in particular. There you have an economy where the physical side of the economy, the machinery, the equipment, had been bombed largely to smithereens. But you still had a large number of highly skilled workers, and they had access to very, very good technology. With skilled workers and access to technology, they were able to rebuild very, very quickly, much more quickly than a lot of people expected. It's not the physical things that matter as much. At an advanced level of development, it really is the intangibles. What policy conclusion does this take us to? This emphasis on growth, this emphasis on productivity. All of the things which we talked about, which lead to productivity growth, physical capital investment, human capital investment, new technology, involve some form of saving and investment. After all, if you're thinking about putting money into new investment, new physical equipment, you need to get that money from somewhere. Perhaps from retained earnings, perhaps from issuing bonds, perhaps from selling stock. But you have to get that money from somewhere and then put it into those new kinds of investments. We don't always think of education in this way, but human capital is also something where really what you're doing is it's a form of saving. Instead of putting the money in the bank and letting it accumulate interest there, you're putting money in yourself, or in your children perhaps, and letting that time and money and energy accumulate. And the skills that they have as a result are going to be skills which help them to earn more money over time, which have an economic payoff. And of course, we talked before about how new technology comes out of research and development and comes out of the incentives that our society provides for people to invest in new kinds of technology and new kinds of research and development. So, if we want to have more savings, more investment, we want to have more productivity growth, we want to try and boost productivity up just a little bit. Because remember, if we can get productivity up from just 1% to 3% over 25 years, over 40 years, it makes an extraordinary difference in our standard of living. What we need to do is figure out better ways to do savings and investment. The obvious answers here are obvious and somewhat helpful, but don't take us as far as they might. One reason that so many economists were strongly in favor of reducing government budget deficits is that they wanted, instead of having the government borrow money, to have that money available to be borrowed by business, and to have that money available to be borrowed by business and invested in other ways. However, now the budget is in surplus. It seems likely to be in surplus the next few years. So getting rid of the deficit is not as easy an answer as it used to be. There are also a number of proposals out there to encourage savings by offering tax benefits to people, individual retirement accounts, 401k accounts, various other kinds of accounts that are out there. The general idea being, save your money, you'll earn some extra interest because of some kind of a tax break. You'll get a higher return. The difficult part of most of those plans is that when you look at them closely, what they tend to show you is that they really do work in terms of getting people to put their money in the special account. But they don't necessarily work in increasing the overall savings rate. One of the patterns that you see in recent years, for example, is that there's a lot more money in IRA accounts and 401k accounts, these tax-favored savings accounts. But it's also true that the amount people have borrowed on their credit cards and borrowed on their home mortgages is higher than it was before. So you can think of it kind of as people borrowing more on their houses and their credit cards and then putting more in the IRA and the 401k. Overall, there's not more savings there. Overall, those two factors just balance each other out. So you can encourage people to put money in certain accounts, but we don't seem very good at figuring out how to encourage them to overall increase their rate of savings. And the overall increase is what we're really looking for. It's not easy to think about ways of increasing saving, and if we don't increase saving, then we don't have the money available for investment. But I think that this problem of how we increase saving and how we increase investment is the single biggest issue facing the American economy over the next several decades. There are a variety of studies out there which tend to show that if you look at the U.S. economy and you do these long-term projections several decades off in the future, what really hurts us is not so much our education system, because while our education system has all kinds of problems on the K through 12 level, we have really superior university education, and that sort of helps balance those two out. We've obviously got good resources for generating technology, although I think we could do a lot better. And we have a market-oriented economy which finances and brings new ideas into being in a way that very few other countries in the world can match. But for decades now, America has had this relatively low savings and investment rate. And if you project out into the future, while we've been able to overcome that for a long time, it's not clear we'll be able to overcome it 20 or 30 years into the future. We really need to think about how we're going to get more saving and investment. One way of doing that, which is being much talked about now, is to reform Social Security in a way which would require people to put money into certain accounts. And by requiring them to put money into private accounts, which you wouldn't get to touch until your retirement, what we're really saying is, we don't know how to encourage people to save, so we're going to force them by law to save. We're going to force them to set aside money in these accounts. And as we force them to put aside those money in accounts, we will, by golly, raise our saving and investment rate by brute force, through forced savings, rather than through delicate kinds of incentives. In the early 1970s, the U.S. productivity growth rate slowed down. Not just the productivity growth rate of the United States, but actually growth rates all over the world slowed down at about the same time. We went from that nice, generous, cheerful 3% growth rate that we'd had through most of the 1950s and 60s, and we came down to about a 1% growth rate. There's some evidence in the mid-90s that maybe this is turning a little bit, but as I give these lectures, that evidence is shaky and feeble, and you really wouldn't want to hang your hat on it a whole lot. Now, that drop-off from 3% to 1% growth is the kind of thing which, when you first hear it, you think, 3%, 1%, now what's a couple of percent? What difference can that make? But think about it in a slightly different way. Remember that drop-off of 2% from 3% to 1% is annual. It happens every year. That's not a one-time fall. So if you go back from the early 1970s up to, say, toward the end of the late 1990s, you've got 25 years there where every year the economy was losing 2%. Multiply that out, and the economy would be losing something like 50%. Of its accumulated size over that time. Now, what does 50% mean? Well, remember, gross domestic product now is about $8 trillion. If the economy had been growing 2% more each year since the early 1970s, instead of having a gross domestic product of $8 trillion, we would have a gross domestic product of $12 trillion. And with $12 trillion, even if the government just kept on taking more or less the same percentage it has now, the government would be rich, we would all feel quite a bit richer than we are now. When you think about that loss of $4 trillion, it just staggers the mind. I don't care what your social goals are. There is no issue which matters as much as the fact that we're missing $4 trillion. There's no social goal you couldn't have paid for with the government revenue from those $4 trillion. And that money is gone. There's no way to get it back. The only thing we can do is plan to try and raise our rate of growth for the years and the decades in the future.